So, brethren, we'll then go to our Revelation 6 study. We're picking up with the third seal. And Sister Gina, would you read for us Revelation 6, verses 5 and 6?
And when he and when he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature saying, "Come." And I saw and behold a black horse, and he that sat thereon had a balance in his hand. And I heard as it were a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A measure of wheat for a shilling, and three measures of barley for a shilling, and the oil and the And the wine hurt thou not."
That's what mine says.
Sorry, I couldn't read that word.
Yeah, that's wine.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That
okay.
It?
Yep, that is. Thanks. That's right. A little delay here. Very good. Sister Gina, we'll let you give any opening comments. Maybe start with what period of time or what time frame are we looking at here with this third?
Wheel. Get my little notes here. Yeah. Okay, so the third seal is the third messenger. So that's Arius. So 313. If I have it right. And then the other thing I have a note on is the black horse. That's papacy. And I have some other notes, but they're a little hard to read. So I'm going to stop there.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Brother Mark, while the mic's open, did you have anything to add?
So that probably the black horse is that they were given the doctrine and they obviously, twisted it, and by this point, I think this is an indication of the false doctrines that they're now spewing out, and you know, idol worship, Mary, and all this other stuff, and we'll leave it at that for now.
Okay, well, very good, very good. Thank you, Sister Debbie.
I was thinking maybe just you know the black horse. Showing the doctrines have been so darkened that no one can see the true, you know, the true doctrines anymore for all the false doctrines that are out there. You know, I was thinking of like black being like night or darkness, so where you can't see over.
All right, very good. Well, that's true. We take if you remove the light of the truth, then you end up with the black. Dark doctrines. Okay, good. Further comments? Pardon.
Along with the comments, Brother Rick, what comes to mind when we hear dark, when we see the deterioration of the truth from white to red to black, we might think of the Dark Ages. And, of course, what made those ages dark was the removal of light. So there wasn't any or there wasn't much light left. But of course the Lord provided what was necessary for the saints. But it's a true picture of the removal of the truth being covered up by the error, the false doctrines, over.
Okay, so good. Appreciate it. Brother Chris? Not hearing you, brother.
Can you hear me now?
I can, thank you.
To put that in a time context, the 1260 years of the Bible being locked up in dead languages, you know, we typically date that from 539 to 1799. And this third stage of the church under Arius, as Sister Gina said, is 313 to 1156. So this black horse covers 1,034 years of that 1,260, major chunk of the 1,260 that we're so familiar with and discuss so often over.
Now, just back up on that, Brother Chris. I grasp what you're saying, but on that dating, the number of years once more, it's from, you said 313 AD to 1156 AD, but you said something about covering 1,000 years or so. Just repeat that.
Well, just for clarification, Arius, we date him as the third messenger starting in 313. But we don't start the 1,260 years when papacy really came into its own until 539. So that's 226 years later than Arius. So I just subtracted that from the 1,260 years, and that gives you 1,034 years from 539. It covers 1156 is when Arius ends. So that's when we start talking about the fourth stage of the church. So that's 1,034 years from Arius. I'm not getting it clear, am I?
Well, I think what you're saying is correct, of course, that in 539 AD, which is in this time period, starts our 1260 years, of which the doctrine was controlled by the papacy more or less, and the Bible was in a dead language. So that 539 to 1156, the end of this period is 617 years. Then you begin the fourth stage of the church. So you got to count all of that in, like you're saying. And then you got your fifth stage of the church. You got to count all that in. And then it's toward the end of the sixth stage, which gives you that long period that you're bringing out. So, the point is important that we start to see this, dramatic increase of power to the papacy in this third period of the church, and that the black does picture mourning, which goes well with your point, Brother Chris, that the Bible was hidden dead languages, the language of Latin, not the common people's language, starting in we date it starting usually 539 and onward. And there's places where Brother Russell even starts that morning in 325 AD with the Council of Nicaea, showing the church council started to replace the power of the Word of God. So you'll find both comments by Brother Russell on Revelation, the 11th chapter, first few verses dealing with the two witnesses being clothed in sackcloth and ashes. But Brother Chris, did you have a follow-up comment?
Just that my math was a little screwed up on that. I was thinking a little convoluted. It is actually 617 years into the 1260, so that's more proper. So it's nearly half of it over.
Yes, for sure. Okay, very good. Brother Mark, then Sister Roseanne, then Sister Sharon.
Just an additional comment with the doctrine. It also shows probably obviously to everybody, but the increase that papacy now has in power with this ability to change and create their own doctrines, because they, as Brother Russell brought out, like in volume two, they were just, you know, just starting back in the other what are these things, seals, and you know, just little groups here and there, followings, and now that it's showing their increased power to do that. They need the power to do that, twist the things.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Good. Thank you. Sister Roseanne.
With the dating that when we first went over this stage of the church, we said it was from 313 to 1157. At least that's what I have in my notes. And I know Brother Chris said 1156, and I know that's probably splitting hairs, but my OCD asks and begs the question, is it 1156 or 1157?
Okay. All right, Brother Chris, we'll let you have the first comment on that.
I just flash back to my notes there on Arius, and in the discussions on that, I got 313 to 1156, but I've got the fourth stage of the church starting at 1157, so I probably am not hard-lined on either one, so it's right in there, so I haven't split the hair fine enough.
Yeah, I know, and it's just me, you know, that it's like, I need to know, you know, kind of thing, so.
No, there's a good answer, and you both are talking about it right, and let's zero in on that. It's in Revelation, the second chapter, in verse 18, 2:18, it's the Thyatira church, which is our fourth stage of the church. It is, the messenger is our Peter Waldo. And it's in verse 21:21. And I gave her space to repent of her fornication, and she repented not. And that space in the Greek word is chronos, mm-hmm. which we take to be a time, which is 360 days, or that may be symbolic of 360 years. So we took the start time of the fourth stage of the church as 11:57 added 360, and it brings us to 1517, the start of the sixth stage, not the fifth, the sixth stage of the church. And that would have been would have been with Martin Luther and the beginning of the Great Reformation and with the 95 Theses. So the point was that, of course, papacy did not repent, and so the Great Reformation came 360 years later. And so I think that's why we make the point that the church, fourth church, started with 1157. That's a point. So, or Chris, I see you nodding your head. I'm thinking that's what you were thinking. So you just end the other church, the third church, a year earlier, right? Was that what you? I think that's what you were meaning.
Well, in the year, so could be a couple of months earlier.
Right. Okay. And Sister Roseanne, is that helpful? You probably had all sorts of notes there on Revelation.
Yeah, I did, and it's. I had us going. Ended at 1157, I guess. It's just something that will gnaw at me unless I get it answered in my head. And so I think it was answered.
Well, good. Appreciate that. But before I call on Sister Sharon, was there any other comment on this point? Brother Chris.
Just that when we were going through these, it was emphasized that some of the start points, for some, it's clear. For others, it's not so clear, but we have ending points. And then we have connectors that give us confidence. But some of them are kind of like, right, you know, it's not like you can nail it down to a month or an event and say this happened. 1517 is an event we can nail down and say that historically we know for certain the sixth age of the church, the messenger was on the scene trumpeting. But Arius is a little, you know, historically we know when he lived, but there's not like an event. We got synods and things that we can look back to with Constantine, and so I just remember us bringing that out a little bit.
Yes, so we did go through this on the churches, that it's rather amazing that we have either an ending or a beginning point or event that's mentioned that is quite satisfying when taken as a whole. Just briefly, we know when the first church could have only begun was at Pentecost. That could have been the earliest you could have started the first stage of the church. We know that with the end of the second stage of the church, it ended with a 10-day or 10-year persecution by the pagan emperors on Christianity. Then the Edict of Milan was given in 313, which allowed for the ending of that persecution. Then we had our conversion of Constantine. He who stood in the way was now removed, adopting nominal Christianity, calling the first great council, 325 A.D., and sat as the emperor over the bishops that he gathered, which Arius was the one, and we have that debate. And then we have this period in the fourth stage of the church that we just considered, Revelation 2:21, which gave us a period of time for the start of the fourth stage of the church by coordinating it with the start of the sixth stage of the church, with this most notable event, as Brother Chris brought out, nailing the 95 Theses on the door of Wittenberg Castle by Luther. It was a lightning rod. Almost all historians recognize that as the start of the Great Reformation. But just in case we had a question on it, you'll remember that in Revelation 9, in our seven trumpets, in our fifth trumpet, which would be the same time frame as our fifth stage of the church. That would have been with John Wycliffe. Revelation 9 and verse 5 says they would be tormented 5 months. And in Revelation 9 and in verse 10, it's repeated. The same time period under Wycliffe, they torment them 5 months. We did the math. 30 days in a month times 5 is 150. So our fifth stage of the church was from 1367 to 1517. Or you might say the fifth stage ended in 1516 and the sixth stage started in 1517. But there is our confirmation of our 150 years, our 5 months for the fifth stage of the church. So in this way, dear brethren, we see that in the Revelation, it does offer us some pretty substantial clues to be able to mark the timing of the events and the messengers and the history. And then, of course, Brother Russell with the seventh. Babylon was cast off, no longer reformable. And so our seventh stage of the church begins with their being cast off, and Brother Russell being the messenger for that period. So, Brother, that's a quick overview. Most of us have studied that, whether here in this meetings or elsewhere. Okay, any comment on that before I go to Sister Sharon? Thank you for your patience, Sister Sharon. Okay, I think we're okay. Sister Sharon.
Yeah, I'm not sure where that, my comment was sort of in between all the others, so I'm not sure I should make it, but I was going to mention that Pergamus meant earthly elevation, and that really was a good thing for the fact, explains the blackness of it, the fact that the Catholic Church got more elevated. And then I also thought I'd bring out the fact that at this point, the empire was divided east and west by Constantine, opening the way for a need for a powerful leader in the west, and they chose the Pope. And then 700 years later, the church itself divided into eastern and western branches, and this might seem like a blow to the apostasy, but quite the contrary, it leaves the Bishop of Rome with more power and authority, and he immediately started executing his authority and placed people in charge of things, and it set the stage for the Europe to have an iron rod of rule for centuries. And it's also the longest period. And so like when you mentioned the Dark Ages, yes, it was definitely a very, very big part of the Dark Ages. And along with all the other things that were going on then, like the Black Plague and so many things going on, people started trying to look to God, and the one source that they seemed to think was the right one was the Catholic Church. So it helped them grow even more with their physical sufferings, with death. And we're seeing that happen even now with the COVID. Apparently people started going to churches more again and trying to find things on websites, which gives us a chance to spread the word. But I thought it was an interesting parallel with that part too. So I'll stop, but I thought that would add a bit to the discussion. Thank you.
Okay, very good. So we'll come back to our symbols. Sister Sharon has started us on events during this 843-year period of this the third church, which helps us identify this third seal. So what other events? Now, I mentioned the Council of Nicaea in 325. Very notable. We had Constantine convert to nominal Christianity. So as Paul told us in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, he who stood in the way is now removed. The Roman emperors, the pagan Roman emperors, stood in the way of the papal ambitions for control. And when Constantine converted to nominal Christianity, I always like to say nominal Christianity, that removed that problem. Now, there was still a contest of who was going to be the top dog in the Roman Empire, but the aspect of the paganism wasn't completely removed, but it started to fade very rapidly. So now, with that being said, what other dates might we have or events of dates? Brother Chris did mention about the start of 539. But maybe before we get to 539, do you have any, did any of you mark down any historical events that jumped out? Well, in 395, some feel that the Mass as a daily celebration was introduced. 395. In 375, the veneration of angels and dead saints was introduced. And in 440, we had Pope Leo the Great, for the papacy he was great, Pope Leo, and they attribute him as being the founder of medieval papacy. And he started the concept that heresy was punishable by death because it was against society. So, obviously, a very marked move in this ascension to power over society. Other events. Ruth.
Well, it's all the way at the end, toward the end, but wasn't it when Charlemagne was crowned during this period, 799?
It's not toward the end, but it's later on for sure. This is a long period, but
that's right, 799. Yeah, all right, okay.
So, what does that do for us when we say Charlemagne was crowned? Why don't you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Well, for the first time, the Pope crowned the emperor. He was of France, but it was he was really the beginning of the Holy Roman Empire, and I believe. And the Pope had the power to crown him, so he acknowledged that the Pope had authority over kings at that point, because it was very marked that when Napoleon was crowned emperor, he wouldn't allow the Pope to crown him. He took the crown out of his hand and put it on him,
himself, and then he crowned Josephine. So it was very marked that Charlemagne allowed himself to be crowned by the Pope. Over.
Okay, very good. Further comments on Charlemagne? Charles the Great, in our language. Charlemagne was the son of King Pepin. Their tribe was known as the Franks. And they were the conquerors of the various other tribes of Europe at that time. And the father, King Pepin, defeated the Lombards. The Lombards controlled much of Italy, the land of Italy. And Pepin gave that to the Pope. That then became the basis for the Papal States. And so when Charlemagne came, the Pope crowned him to be, as Ruth said, emperor. So they had been kings, but to be made the emperor put him in a loftier role than other kings of that empire. And that, as Ruth said, that began what was to be further known as the Holy Roman Empire, and it made the Pope what's hinted at in Isaiah 23, the bestower of crowns. And they report that Charlemagne was a bit surprised by that, but nonetheless, that is what took place, and then it set the precedent thereafter, and that solidified the Papal States. And it, with Papal States, this kind of territory, it in fact solidified the Pope as a civil and religious ruler, even more so than what he had had from the previous a previous event, which we're all familiar with, of Emperor Justinian in 533, recognizing the Bishop of Rome as the head of all the churches. That is, now I'm going backwards in time a little bit, 533, which set the stage for our 539 date of the start for our 1260 years and our 1290 years and our 1335 years. Very odd event there. So let's ask about that. What happened in 539? Probably seeming rather insignificant, but it set a precedent. 539. Brother Chris, and then Brother James and Ruth.
Well, that was the year that Justinian, being in Constantinople, the east of Europe, Byzantium, the Pope rising in power in the west, in Italy, he gave over the title of Pontifex Maximus, which was the religious authority. He was, prior to that, the emperors were both religious leaders and civil leaders. So when he gave that title over to the Pope, the papacy, he became the sole civil authority, and the Pope became the sole religious authority. And so prior to 539, the dragon gave orders to everybody. But after 539, the civil authority carried out the orders that came from the Pontifex Maximus. So they became the servant of the religious head. Over.
All right. Thank you, Brother Chris. Very good. James, Brother James?
I don't have much to add to that. Just, I don't know if you're asking for more of the history of it in Italy, what was happening, like that minor event that happened was that there was a lot of invaders. I believe that's the Ostrogoths, and it was Justinian's general that was able to kind of quell a lot of that, but then he feared that his general might have too much power or sway or influence, and so he thought it'd be easier if he just puts the bishop in Rome in charge over there to kind of take care of things in that part of the empire. Over.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Good. Ruth.
Yeah, I was looking for the footnote in the, I think it's in the second volume about the, or maybe it's in the Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. I can't remember, but that the Ostrogoths were defeated and they were Aryan. And so when they were defeated, the Pope rose, got the, a lot more power in 539. So he really became, in fact, the ruler instead of just in writing. So, you know, Justinian gave him the letter in said he was in 533, but he really didn't have the power till the Ostrogoths were defeated. But I can't find the, I'm looking for it in the second volume. I'll let you know if I, over.
Okay. No, that's very good. Sister Sharon.
Now, to add, this isn't as much politics as it is making the horse become black, is the fact that then the Nicene Council, when it officially established itself as the defining of what doctrine would be, the Trinity was given a big official status. And then the Universal Creed, the Nicene Creed, came into existence, and that really made the errors get sealed in stone. And then the period was full of just all kinds of twists with doctrines. And the Bible in its final form was written for that time. And Constantine arranged, this is an interesting thought I thought you'd find good. Constantine arranged to have many copies made of that Nicene Creed with all their errors and packed into them. And one of the copies was found in the 1800s in a monastery in the Sinai Desert by Tischendorf. And we use Tischendorf's notes and comments for a number of things. And they refer to it as the Sinaitic manuscript. Unfortunately, the Nicene Creed has lasted just as long, but is better known than that one. But at least I thought that was a bit of history to add to what was happening to our scriptures, making that horse be very, very black as well. Thank you.
All right. Very good. So the debate between Arius and Athanasius was whether or not God and Jesus were homoousia, of the same substance. Arius argued against that because it would make Jesus equal to God. Arius lost that debate, as we know. The emperor made the decision on which way it should go. And the Arian-leaning bishops in the minority were then cast down out of the supposed heavens, the spiritual leadership role at the time, and Arius himself excommunicated. Later reinstated by the emperor, and on his way back to Rome, was poisoned and killed. Yet, that Sister Sharon's point that God and Jesus were considered equal, that was solidified. Didn't make the Trinity, but it paved the way for the Trinity. The Holy Spirit was added a little later, but it definitely paved the way. And worse than that, if there's a worse than that, is that it established church councils as superior to the Word of God for authority. Okay, back to our 539 AD. Brother Godwin.
I have a small note here for this going along with the Ostrogoth Wars. It's called the Siege of Ravenna. Just wanted to let the French know.
Okay, very good. So that was the point. Justinian's general Belisarius went to put down the Ostrogoth rule in Italy, as it were. And the Ostrogoths had solidified their capital at an Italian town known as Ravenna. They were besieged. But quite often it's curious that some commentators use 588 for this period of time. But actually, Ruth was referring, it's a footnote in Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. In that footnote on this period of time, it states that there was a letter discovered in 539 that had been written in Ravenna and yet had been delivered outside of the city, demonstrating that the siege was lifted in 539 by Belisarius defeating those Ostrogoths there at Ravenna. Well, what that left was a power vacuum in the western side of the Roman Empire. As the friends know, Justinian was in the eastern part of the empire. He was in the city that had been built by Constantine, a predecessor, known as Constantinople, which went through various name changes. Byzantium, modern-day Istanbul. But the point is, Justinian needed a leader for the people of the Western Empire to look to. And he sent some leaders over, as it were, as they were like political military types. However, the Bishop of Rome became the de facto leader that the people looked to because he was consistently there and they felt consistently there back from the very beginning for centuries. And as brought out, Justinian had recognized that the Bishop of Rome was the head of all the churches. That played into Justinian's role of recognizing a leader over there, not a civil leader yet, a religious leader. However, that turned into being considered a civil leader by lack of any other civil leader having more prestige and authority than the Bishop of Rome. So that's that little bit of background, which many commentators have missed, yet it fits so wonderfully with all the rest of the time prophecies, the three time prophecies in Daniel's book, that we can look at both the beginning date and the ending date. So we have that let's take a look at it since we're talking this much about it. It's so important. It's in Daniel, the 12th chapter. And let's see. Sister Alice, could you read there for us? Daniel 12 and verse 11 for us, please. Daniel 12:11.
Okay, Daniel 12:11. And from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days.
A comment for us on that?
Well, the time that this would happen would be 539. And then the 1290 days would take up to 1829 when William Miller began to have truth on the time prophecies. So that abomination was set up and in power for 1290 days.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Ruth?
Yeah, I found what I was looking for. It's in the third volume. And it starts on page 69, and it goes about 12 pages. It explains all about the Ostrogoths and Pepin and Charlemagne and everything you were just saying. So anyway, that, in case anyone's taking notes, it starts on 69, and it goes almost like to 82.
Okay, very good. Very helpful. Thank you. And, brethren, just a note, for Brother Russell to spend that much time developing that point, it's because of these time prophecies in Daniel 12 that it gives us the proper interpretation. And just a quick point on this verse 11. Brother Russell brings out that both conditions had to be true to start the time prophecy. Sister Alice brought out the right thoughts. the daily sacrifice shall be taken away. That means that Christ's once for all ransom sacrifice was replaced by the transubstantiation doctrine of the Mass to replace it. Now, that had been in existence. We brought that out earlier. That had already been in existence. But for it to be set up, that has the note of being set up in power. So it became empowered through this power vacuum in Italy, the Western Empire, in 539 when the Ostrogoths were defeated. So that's our timing and our starting points. So anything else here on Daniel 12:11? Okay. So then going back, and we're talking about any more historical features during this third seal or third church period, was there, we've got in 786, the worship of images and the cross were authorized. So we're seeing the ceremony, the trappings, these Roman Catholic type of, and even Eastern Orthodox type of worship practices being instituted. And then in, we've got that start of the papal millennium from 800 to 1799. It's the counterfeit millennium of the Holy Roman Empire, so to speak, till as brought out, Napoleon broke that. Brother James.
I've got a good one in, I believe it was 572, I think it was. Or, there was a council in Portugal. It goes along with the dark horse or the black horse, because that's when they started instituting the long black tunics that the priest would wear. So that was an interesting one. And then also in 1139, the Second Lateran Council is where they instituted celibacy for the priests. Over.
Okay, both very good. Very important developments. Long-ranging dire effects. Very good. Sister Debbie.
Just stepping back for a moment, I had to leave for a second, but did anyone bring up the idea that in 452, Pope Leo the Great met Attila the Hun and persuaded him to turn back from his invasion of Italy, and the people looked upon the Pope for doing this as, like, you know, a great man. Over.
Pope Leo was brought up, but not that aspect, which undoubtedly was considered to be a great thing. Very good. Okay, further historical events during this time. Anything else anyone wants to bring out? Berlin.
Not an event, Brother Rick, but a question. You mentioned earlier that heresy was, and I didn't get the point in time in history, was punishable by death. And we see, of course, in this period of time, that these false doctrines lent themselves to this terrible treatment of human beings, being able to say, well, if you don't believe in a Trinity or hellfire or what have you, then that's a heresy against society, against the church, against God, and you can be tortured or put to death. But I didn't hear if you gave a date for that particular event, if you will, in history.
Pope Leo the Great, as Sister Debbie was just talking about, was the one that made that declaration, and he was Pope from 540. I said that wrong. Sorry. 440 to 461. So somewhere in that time frame. But that is a very important development to think about. All right. Well, the Eastern and Western churches split in 1054. And the Patriarch of Constantinople area, as it were, didn't recognize the headship of the Roman Pope over the church. So that was the Great Schism, 1054. So that fit in this time frame. All right, brother. I don't know that we need to continue along that line. Ruth? Sister Debbie? Cindy Harrison?
I'm just looking in Mosheim. It doesn't give a year, but it has the 10th century was when the worship of Mary reached its zenith and the rosary. Over.
Yes, I had 431 when Mary was declared the Mother of God. 431. Very good. Sister Devin?
Just a quick note that what Brother Dan was bringing out was the Ecumenical Council of Chalcedon. I don't know how to say that city, but Chalcedon. Over.
All right, thank you. Sister Cindy.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. This kind of might sound kind of odd coming from me, but if someone were to want to research this, to what source would they go? I mean, with like the historical, would you find this in the Catholic encyclopedias, or, you know, because I'm not real interested in sifting through all of the church fathers, because there's like thousands of them. So if you wanted to research this, what sources would you use? Over.
So, okay, no, you're asking a good question. So is it research it or just be told by a reliable source like we've been doing?
Just be told by a reliable source.
I like this book right here. Whoops. The Seven Churches of Revelation by Brother Charles Redeker. There's a booklet put together. He does a nice job in dating these highlight events for the seven periods of the church. That was printed later. I mean, more recently, but still years ago. Don't get me wrong. So prior to that, we use sources. One of my favorites was the Northwest Detroit Revelation Notes. We happened to attend those meetings back in 1978 when I first came into the truth. That was an ad hoc group of brethren in the Metro Detroit area who met Friday nights and studied Revelation. And it was good. It was always, it was in harmony with the harvest message. So we would do just like what Ruth was doing, looking in the volumes and culling out all the places that Brother Russell gives us historical references. And as we know, like on our Friday night study currently in the third volume, he gives you a lot of various writers to refer to pull that together. So there's those. The Will Durant series is helpful. He's not much of a God-fearing man, but it's somewhat helpful. Cooper's Bible History is good. So those were all the various ways. Haley's Bible Handbook was good. So you have these variety of sources that we use over the years, but then when Charlie Redeker put this booklet together, it helped us consolidate it. It didn't prove it. You still had to prove it for yourself, but it gave you a nice list to work from. All right. Anyone else on that? Ruth.
Also, I was looking through my Mosheim, and he says in the 5th century was when confession started. And he said that by this change, one of the greatest restraints upon licentiousness was entirely removed.
Okay, indeed. And Sister Cindy, you may remember Brother Godwin posted the Mosheim connecting link, which has multiple page listings of various issues, rulers, popes, emperors, problems. it was quite long. And then
yeah,
you,
I remember that.
Okay, good. And then you got Brother Chris in the next room. He'll good
yeah,
source.
Yeah, there's all, yeah, there you go.
All right. So, brethren, let's now turn to the our symbolic language of these two verses back in Revelation 6 and in verse 5. The third living creature, you know, we suggested when we studied the living creatures that this was God's character attribute of love. There'll be a difference of opinion on that, but we favor that it was love. That justice. That when he opened the third seal, that this living creature was God's justice, who was offended by the rider on the black horse having his own balances. And he, that rider on the black horse, is measuring out wheat and barley. And this is a this is an unjust, unequitable balance that this rider has in his hands. The rider is the Antichrist system headed under the Pope. The doctrine as talked about is black because it's a truth is in mourning, as it were, but it is the absence of light and truth. So it is black, and it is a further decaying, as it were, of the true doctrines. So that now we have this three measures of barley for a penny versus one measure of wheat for the same price, a penny. So you can, for the same effort, one penny, you can get three times the barley than you can the wheat. And with this rider being the Antichrist system, we know with this black horse condition that this barley being more plentiful must represent error. Error of doctrine and error of practice. So that it made it much more costly at self-sacrifice for the saintly ones of that time to secure just a measure of wheat or truth. And because of that, as we know, the Lord, a voice in the midst of the four living creatures, which is the Lord God Almighty. Let's take a look back at the fourth chapter. Look at verse, let's see. Oops, sorry, I'm not catching what I was hoping to put my hand on right away.
Brother Rick?
Yep.
While you're, can I read something that I thought was interesting with the balances?
Just a second. Let's find this before we lose sight of it. We've got a mist. We've got a voice coming out of the midst of the throne somewhere, and I thought I had it, and I don't. So anyone who has that verse, just go ahead and speak up while I'm looking away, and then I'll...
Verse 5?
4, 5. And out of the throne proceeded lightning, thunderings, and voices. I think I had something else in mind, but that...
The next verse?
Okay. Before the throne, see a glass like an epistle, and in the midst of the throne and round about the throne were the four living creatures. Very well. Maybe that's all there. Maybe that's what it is. I just really wasn't remembering it well. Let me take one last look at something here. Okay, I'm going to let it go because I'm not finding it better than that, but I do think it this voice represents God, and God is recognizing that the doctrine, the true doctrine and the true, his true children are, under severe pressure. And so in this voice coming out, he is showing that even though he's allowing this permission of evil in the church, the permission of evil of the decay of the true doctrine with the rise of error, yet he puts a limit on it. Just like he put a limit on Satan when Satan wanted to persecute Job, the righteous man. God allowed him to do what he would, but he did put a limit. You can't kill him. And so this seems to be a similar fashion. God is recognizing the detrimental, horrific situation that's come upon the church. It is the true church at this time. But he puts a limit on it. He puts a limit on what Satan through the Antichrist system could accomplish. You can't snuff out and put to death the true church or the truth completely. All right, Sister Sharon, thanks for waiting.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the word bread, and I found a nice example of how that balance has worked. And this is a kind of a yoke balance, because it's talking about it being because it says he's carrying a pair of balances. An additional thought is conveyed to indicate so that would be that bread was a scarcity. There was a time of hunger. It was a time of famine as well in earthly senses in that period several times. And so when we're looking at Leviticus 26:26, that shows how the Lord treated a time for them. I'm going to start with 25. And I will bring a sword upon you and shall avenge the quarrel of my covenant when they had defied the covenant. And when ye have gathered together within your cities, I'll send pestilence. And when you have broken the staff of your bread, 10 women shall bake your bread in one oven, and they shall deliver your bread again by weight. And they shall eat, and you shall eat and not be satisfied. It won't be enough bread for you to eat. And that was the curse that he placed upon them at that time in explanation. And so when you think about this balance being like a yoke, like on two cattle, you know, it also denotes the fact that this balance is being carried by these two powerful creatures, and the fact that this yoke comes from the word zugos, in its primary sense means a yoke. So that's where that word for this pair of balances comes from. And then the choice of the word is basically to identify the fact that the measuring is named a yoke beam balance scale. So it shows just a terrific limitation of what bread would be allowed. And so I thought that was something to add to it. The fact that he's using a pair of balances as a yoke balance. And that signifies a lot. This signifies many things when we're looking at having a yoke as a burden carrier. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Very good. Brother James and then Brother Chris.
My comment also was on the balance or the scales, and just knowing that oftentimes God uses measurement as a measurement of time, like the measuring rod and whatnot. And I was pairing this with Daniel 7, verse 25, when he says, "And he shall speak great words," meaning the man of sin, "against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until the time of times and the dividing of time." And that it would, I think it pairs well with this because it's the, with the Pope trying to establish the church ahead of its time and, wearing out the saints, so the saints are in darkness. It's similar to Elijah being in the wilderness for that time, those 3.5 years. Anyways, I thought it pairs well with this verse. Over.
All right, very good. Yes, taking upon itself to change what the Lord had instituted to an extent. All right, good. Brother Chris.
Just first emphasize that those balances are the universal symbol of justice. We know that. And so that's what assures that not being love, but justice really being offended. And secondly, I was always a little confused by that sentence. You know, there's three measures of barley. There's all that air. And yet he says, hurt not the oil and the wine. But we know that there is a measure. For a penny, you can still get some wheat, even though it's slim pickings compared to the multitude of the barley. And so we know that throughout the gospel age, during the dark ages, there were the faithful, just like in our discussions and our other studies, spirit begotten in Babylon, etc. So there is enough wheat not to hurt their good heart condition. That's their Holy Spirit. And the wine is the true doctrine. So there's enough to hold on to even in spite of all these errors. And we know even most of our messengers had error, but they did have one good truth that was able to get God's message across to sustain them throughout the gospel age. Over.
All right. Very good. Appreciate that. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
Just real quick, Brother Rick, were you thinking of Revelations 5:6? And lo, in the midst of the throne and of the four living creatures and in the midst of the elders, a lamb hath stood as it had been slain.
That's
one you're thinking of?
In the midst of the elders stood. Well, that's the lamb. That's the lamb. So that would be Jesus. So no, I was thinking, that it's God being depicted here. That
and verse 7 too, if you look at.
And he came and took the book out of the right hand of him that sat upon the throne.
And well, that's like in the midst.
I think Revelation 4:1.
4:1. I heard as it were a trumpet talking with me.
And the first voice which I heard was as it were of a trumpet. Revelation 4:1. That's not the voice? The voice?
Well, I think that kind of goes back to the first chapter where he heard the voice like a trumpet. Revelation 1:10. That would be the Lord's instructions coming to him. Without getting further into it, I feel pretty confident that the one that was in the midst being mentioned in chapter 6. For myself, I'm pretty convinced that it's the Lord God Almighty that's being referred to here, who has the ability and power to put the brakes on the Antichrist's influence, that it can't completely obliterate the truth or the effect of the truth, the wine, the joy of doctrine, even though it had all this other rising power. Sister Debbie. Oh, sorry. Wait a minute. Ruth.
Well, it's just a additional thought, but I like that when you get to the same message in the churches, Revelation 2:17, the little flock that has to survive during this period is given the promise of the hidden manna, that they would eventually get incorruptible food, that even though they have to survive during this period on the famine rations, they will eventually have the promise of getting immortality or incorruptible food. Over.
Yeah, and that's good. You that's a nice connection. Also, in the first stage of the church in chapter 2, verse 7, one of the promises is, I'll give you to eat of the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. So while we know those are spiritual hopes, it shows that they might be being starved, which we'll see more in the fourth seal, but they are struggling to get their spiritual nourishment during this third stage. Very difficult. Sister Debbie.
No, I was just thinking that along with what you said about God is in the midst of the living creatures, and I think about the Ezekiel picture of God, you know, the throne is surrounded by the living creatures, you know, with the faces and the wings. So that too kind of shows God is in the midst of the living creatures because they are his aspects, his attributes. Over.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Now, brethren, the New Testament nicely gives us a picture of the value or cost. What does it take to earn a penny? I think the Greek might be denarius, but nonetheless, Brother Dan. Can't hear you.
Yeah, in the parable of the penny, it was a day's wages. They had to work a full day and they received the penny. And so I was thinking the wheat measured out, you get a penny's worth. So it shows the value of the truth, a full day's wage. You had to work very, very hard and truly desire the truth that was available, which was very scarce. Over.
All right. Very good. Indeed. They really had to struggle to get that little bit of truth where the error was so plenteous. That shows the unfair balance by the writer, the clergy, headed by the popes during that period. They were dealing out more error than they were truth. Now, what symbolism is suggested for the barley representing error, even though the obvious, what might we have regarding barley? Because barley is a good food. There is a slight hint in the Old Testament that the brethren have used over the years. Is anyone familiar with that? Sister Cindy?
I was thinking, wasn't there a barley offering in the Old Testament? They had the various grain offerings, wheat and whatnot, but I thought there was a barley offering as well. Over.
Yep, there's the first sheaves of that barley harvest in the spring. That's true. But if no one's picking up on it, I'll just take us there. Brethren have suggested this. It's in Numbers, the fifth chapter. In Numbers 5. We're not going to read the whole thing. It's not really needed for what we're our consideration. But I'm going to, let's see here. Brother Adi, can you read for us in Numbers 5? Read a verse. Twelve through 15. And then, let's see, we'll read that first for us, please.
5:12-15. Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him so that another man has sexual relations with her, and this is hidden from her husband, and her impurity is undetected, since there is no witness against her and she has not been caught in the act. And if feelings of jealousy come over her husband and he suspects his wife and she is impure, or if he is jealous and suspects her even though she is not impure, then he is to take his wife to the priest. He must also take an offering of a tenth of an ephah of barley flour on her behalf. He must not pour olive oil on it or put incense on it because it's a grain offering for jealousy, a reminder offering to draw attention to wrongdoing.
Okay.
So here, barley represents something with wrongdoing.
And then verse 29, please.
And then, is the law of jealousy when a woman goes astray and makes herself impure while married to her husband.
Okay. Do you have any comments on that, Brother Adi?
Not on 29.
Or on any of that, what you just
said. Yeah, it's an offering. It's kind of interesting because it's an offering that the husband has to make for her, I believe. And it's for wrongdoing.
Okay. Now, Sister Brenda. Thank you, Brother Adi.
But isn't verse 31 interesting as well? Because it says, then the man shall be free from iniquity, but that woman shall bear her guilt. So wouldn't then the church, in that sense, be bearing the guilt and the people be free because they were led blindly over?
Okay, very interesting. So is anyone familiar with this? It really goes, you know, from 12 through 31. Has anyone considered that recently? Let me just do it. Sister Sharon. Okay, I'm glad you have.
Yeah, in those movies that we were, not movies, those tours that we do with Brother Paul Magno, there was an explanation of how they brought these offerings, like the barley offerings and the meal offerings. And they showed pots, and they were like pots that were shaped kind of rounded at the bottom, not flat. And they came up and they had two rings, and then they had the nozzle. And when you bring an offering, you have to put very, very clean barley or whatever grain offering or whatever you're putting in there, because there's different kinds of offerings. And this has to be a non-used bottle. So it has to be a new bottle made. And then you have to put your item in that you're putting in, like the barley, clean. And then afterwards you present this. And then afterwards you're not allowed to use that bottle again. And so there was a great big ditch dug by the tabernacle and the other places that they were using this, they threw away these pots in this big hole in the ground. And so, man, it was, because the first time I read these barley offerings, I thought, well, that doesn't sound like a big deal. Just carry some barley over in a cup or whatever. You know, it didn't strike me how big a deal it was. But when I saw that when they made these offerings, they had to get a new pot and they had to put the barley in clean. And if the barley had touched the hem of their skirt, they had to get another fresh pot. It had to be never touched the hem of their skirt. So this offering of these grain offerings was really very specifically, very carefully, very precisely done, and at the cost of that pot as well as the time and things involved in it. So I thought I'd bring that out. That made these barley offerings even more sensitive in that way. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And just for time's sake, I'm going to try to make this little part smaller. Thank you. This is the test on whether or not the wife was indeed unfaithful with another man or not. It's if the man suspected that she had been unfaithful, his wife had been unfaithful, he was to bring this offering, and then the priest will mix some dirt off the floor of the tabernacle in with water, and it moves forward, she has to drink it. And depending on whether or not her thigh rots and she has other difficulties, it would prove her guilty or not. And if she wasn't guilty, then she's good. If she was guilty, she'll bear her shame. And in either case, the husband will know the answer. And if she wasn't guilty of fornication or adultery, then good. Or playing the harlot, good. And if so, then it would be made manifest. So the brethren have suggested in years gone by that why did God use the picture of barley in our revelation setting, that you could get more barley than you could the wheat? Well, the wheat we always associate with something good. Our parable of the wheat and the tares, we got the wheat as good. But in this situation here, the brethren have theorized or suggested that as the barley was used as part of testing whether or not the wife had been unfaithful in adultery, it might suggest that at this third period of the church, the nominal church had become adulterous. And indeed, the nominal church was guilty of fornicating with the kings of the earth, which we read about, or I should say we talked about, with Charlemagne or with Pepin receiving earthly gifts of land. So that this is a very loose association, but it does demonstrate that this barley had an association with the testing of harlotry. So that's it. That's all we got. Does anyone have anything more on the barley here, why we would have three times the barley more than wheat? Is there any other suggestion? Brother James.
It might be the same, but as you were saying, but just putting my own, it's going to, you're going to need to use the barley more because there's going to be so much jealousy or error, sin or whatever have you. I also noticed that barley is mostly used for feeding livestock compared to wheat. You wouldn't use wheat to feed your livestock, but they use barley because it doesn't have to be processed. It's just whole. It's over.
Okay. Very interesting. All right. Other comments on this? Brother Godwin.
For the three measures, I have a Bible verse associated. It's in Matthew 13, verse 33. Could I read it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another parable spake unto them, the kingdom of heaven is like unto leaven, which a woman took and hid in three measures of meal till the whole was leavened. So here again, the leavening and the three measures being associated as the errors.
That's intrigued. Very good. Very good. All right. Just looking to see any other hands. Okay. So going back, as our time is expiring here, going back to our Revelation 6, I think we've talked well that the Lord, this voice out of the four living creatures, God's four attributes, this voice saying that, even though God's justice is recognizing this imbalance, more error than truth, the one controlling it, the rider on the horse, being the clergy of Antichrist systems, yet there is a limitation that the oil, the Holy Spirit, Spirit begettal, was still possible. There was enough truth available for that. And that the wine, there's an Old Testament verse, which I don't have at my fingertips, that talks about that the wine makes the spirit joyful. But something similar. But the brethren have often used it to say the wine shows the joy of the doctrine. The joy of the doctrine. So that the saints who struggled, even though they had to give a whole day's labor for just one measure of wheat, truth, yet it was enough to spirit beget them and keep them pressing on. So brethren, we'll leave it there. We'll pick up with verse 7 and talk about that is it. I think we'll leave it. We'll say we've covered our third seal. And next week, Lord willing, we'll go to our fourth seal, verse 7. Brother Chris.
Maybe next week we can just touch on John chapter 6, verses 9 through 15, because Jesus feeds the 5,000 using barley loaves. And if there's any connection as to, you know, why it specifies barley loaves. Just to round it out, maybe we can just touch on it.
Okay. Bring it up, Sister Day.
Ecclesiastes 10:19. For mirth they are making a feast, and wine maketh life joyful.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Good. That's probably the verse I was thinking of. Thank you.